And now at this time, I would like to introduce Dwayne for introducing our spiritual speaker for this morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Everybody looks bright. Yes. All right, so it's my honor to introduce the spiritual speaker this morning. We served together as delegates in 2016 through 2018, Panel 56, and our slogan was "Get Your Kicks with Panel 56." So that you can tell where we were at. And I used to like to walk down the hallway at a conference with Eloy, because anytime I walk down the hallway, nobody said anything to me, you know. You guys can understand that, you know. And but if I was with him, everybody was like, "Hey, Eloy," you know, and I thought just by being with him, you know, I was going to start getting recognized, you know. So nice. He's such a nice person and gets along with everybody, everybody liked him. Now, I will tell you, before we get away, I got taken back to the airport this right about noon. But before he gets gone, if you want to get some good recipes, this man can cook, and he's got some really good recipes that he tries out. But anyway, with that, I introduce Eloy M. from Colorado, past delegate, Panel 56.
Good morning. My name's Eloy Martinez. My closest friends call me E, so you're very welcome to call me E if you like. They've been calling me that for decades now. I am a grateful member of Al-Anon Family Groups. I have been attending consistently since June 24th, 2005. I am sponsored. My sponsor is sponsored, and I sponsor other men. I currently serve at the local and area level. My home group is a Monday morning 10 a.m. step-by-step meeting. And we're on Zoom. If you want to join us, you're very welcome to join us there sometime. I want to thank Dwayne. He was the perfect host. He's been thoughtful and considerate and kind. I've had three surgeries on my left knee, and Dwayne just really did a top shelf job of taking care of me. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. I also want to thank the panel for the invitation to come here. I'm very glad to be here today and spend some time with everybody here. You've all been so friendly, and you've all made me feel welcome. And putting on an assembly, it's no easy chore. If you can get through putting on an event like this and nobody got a toaster bath, it was a pretty good event. I also want to thank AA. I don't know if AA is in the room today, but if AA is in the room, thank you for letting us use your steps, traditions, and concepts. And thank you for letting us tailor them to meet our own needs. And also above that, my story changed forever in 2021, spring of 2021. And I gained a deeper appreciation for both fellowships. My younger brother, Ted, was diagnosed with cancer that spring, spring of 2021. He was a member of AA, and he was, his sobriety date, it just occurred to me last night, his sobriety date is October 15th, today, 1986. He passed away April 9th, 2001, he was stone cold sober the last 34 and a half years of his life. So AA, if you're... if you're in the room, AA, thank you for the gift of a sober brother for all those years. He was generous, kind, he was funny, and he was intensely spiritual. So thank you, AA, and thank you, Al-Anon, and thank you, women in Al-Anon, because you didn't keep this program to yourself. You know, our founders are Lois and Ann, and they let us men come in also, who are also affected by alcoholics. So thank you for not keeping the program to yourself, and thank you for teaching me how to get through the times that I grieve, and I really appreciate that. My sister-in-law, Julie, she told this story about 40 years ago, and it's become relevant now. But 40 years ago, you know, I don't know what I was, 30-something or late 20s, but she spoke about a single, girlfriend that she had, a single mom, and it's around holiday time. It's around Thanksgiving, I think. And this mom has two little kids, and I picture about a 6-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. And Dwayne just gave me a very flowery introduction. But this is more appropriate, I think. This single mom is getting her two kids ready for a road trip. They're going to grandma's house for Thanksgiving, and it's early morning. She gets wakes the kids up and tells them, get your coat, get a toy, and go to the bathroom. It's going to be a long drive to grandma's for the holiday. So mom's getting ready. She's loading up the car. She comes back later, and the kids are just being kids. They're doing the same thing. And she tells them, get your coat, get a toy, and go to the bathroom. It's going to be a long drive. And mom goes back to loading up the car, and she comes back a third time, and there's the two kids, and they're still doing little kid things. And she says, I told you, we got to leave. Get your coat, get a toy, and go to the bathroom. Have you been to the bathroom yet? And that 6-year-old son looks up at her, and he says, Mom, you're the boss of me, and you're the boss of us, and you're the boss of a lot of things, but you're not the boss of my poop. And sometimes that's, you know, a more appropriate introduction would be, I think sometimes I'm the boss of other people's poop. So let me reintroduce myself. My name's Eloy Martinez. I am judgmental. I am self-righteous. I'm critical. I'm sarcastic, and I have a low self-esteem. My beautiful bride, Kathy, isn't here with me today. I married late in life. She's my one and only. After being single for 43 years, while you women didn't find a man who was sarcastic and self-righteous and all those things very attractive, so I married late in life. She's my one and only. We were married June 11th, 1995. June 11th. 1995. My wife and I are such different people. She actually thinks before she speaks. Step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. June 20th, 2005, 10 years after we were married, almost to the day. It's the Monday after Father's Day. I get home from work. I grab something off the stove and I sit down to watch the news. And Kathy's outside, maybe in the garden. And she comes in and she says, it's over. I want a divorce. Pack a bag and leave. And my jaw hit the floor. I was never expecting anything like that. We had been drifting for a few months, several months, maybe even a year or two. And I hadn't done anything about it. I had attended Al-Anon from 93 to 96. And I also usher at my church. And I would see this stunning brunette come to my door at church, and I'd hand her her bulletin, and then I saw her go sit down, and we met a few weeks later, and we married about 2 years later. And about a year after we married, I quit going to Al-Anon. And when I was going to Al-Anon then, I was working at about as thin as you could. I went to my one meeting a week for my 3-minute share, and my shares were just blather. There was no substance to them. I was full of ego, attitude, and agenda. I was there in a self-righteous way, really. Let me back up a little bit further. I grew up in north central New Mexico. Between Santa Fe and Taos, New Mexico, there's a bunch of little towns. And I grew up in a little town called Santa Cruz, just outside of Española, New Mexico. I grew up in a religious home. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was a Marine in World War II. He participated at, he was in the invasion at Guadalcanal, Bougainville, and Guam. He was wounded in Guam, and that was the end of the war for him. Dad came home and started his family in the late 40s. And I remember as a little kid, my mom would say, your dad's having nightmares. You boys need to be extra good today. I had two brothers, one older and one younger, my brother Ted that I was talking about earlier. And mom would tell us, boys, you need to be extra good today. Your dad's having a rough day. And when we asked her what she meant, she said, your dad has nightmares, bad nightmares. You know, he wakes up sweating and he's wrestling with the blankets and he's swearing and all these things. And, you know, we didn't understand PTSD or any of that, any of those things back then. So you boys be extra good today. I think that war made Dad see things he never thought he'd see and do things that he never thought he'd do and become somebody he never thought he'd become. And then I think he drank to forget that war. But when he drank to forget that war, he forgot the ones he loved the most. He forgot us. And growing up in that household, some of you will be familiar. There were bumps and bruises and blood along the way. It was pretty rough when Dad was drunk. I need to include that when Dad was sober, he was an incredible father. He was everything a little boy wanted in a dad. Camping trips, picnics, adventures. Dad was funny. He was protective. He was everything a boy wanted in a dad. My dad was also a fireman for the township of Los Alamos, New Mexico. And, you know, as a little kid, I'm thinking my dad's a Marine. He was decorated. He had medals. And now he's a fireman. And in my mind, Dad was a hero. I remember when I was in fourth grade, my younger brother Ted was in third grade. My older brother Frank is in seventh grade. And we're all at the same school there. And Dad also volunteered for our local volunteer fire department. And one day after school, there's the five buses. The school bell rings and there's the five buses lined up over there. There's parents and cars over there waiting for the kids. And there's a fire truck, a fire engine. And there's my dad waving to us three boys to come on, get on board. And it was at a time when the firemen were still riding on the backs of the engines. So we got on board with Dad on the back of that engine and rode away in front of all our friends, the sirens going a little bit, the bells dinging a little bit. And, you know, it's like you come back to school the next day, you're kind of a hero for a while. You know, everybody just remembered that. But that's who Dad was when he was sober. He was an incredibly good, good man. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, I had a connection with God, but the God that I had was punitive. Growing up in a religious home, it was kind of that God sees what you're doing and God's going to get you. It was kind of that punitive God that I grew up with. In my mind, that's who God was. I had come to Al-Anon, like I said, in 1993 to 96. And I came for the wrong reasons. I really came to help you people. I was sure I had some bit of advice or something to offer you that you didn't have, and I was going to make your lives better. So I was sacrificing myself for you at that time. And again, I worked the program about as thin as I could. I got a sponsor, but I'd crack a book about 15, 20 minutes before I was to meet with him, just so I had something to say. I went to my one meeting a week, like I said, for my 3-minute share, and that was my program. But now, Kathy wants a divorce, and it just crushed me. I was broken. I couldn't wait to get back to my Al-Anon meeting. I was hoping it was still there. This is about the time I think I heard God say, "Eloy, one of us needs to change, and I'm pretty sure it isn't me." So I'm living with some friends of mine at church. I had called up Phil and Helen when Kathy said she wanted a divorce. We were in a Bible study with Phil and Helen at our church a couple of years earlier. And Phil, they're very compassionate people. And after I gave them a thumbnail sketch of what was going on with Kathy and me, Phil, they invited me over. They had a guest room and they invited me over. So I'm staying with Phil and Helen now. I'm just leaving my home. I've got a small bag packed with a few clothes. I live in Fort Collins, but my project that I was working was down in Denver, which is about 65 miles away, and it's interstate travel. So I'm leaving Phil and Helen's about 5:30 to get to my project at 7 in the morning, and I'm back home about 6:30 at night. And all that week, I don't think I slept for, I don't think I slept 8 hours that whole week. I'm just so overcome with grief. Everything I wanted, my wife, my family, a home, it's just being ripped away just like that. And I'm crushed. I'm broken. Step three says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Kathy served papers on me that first week about Wednesday. Somebody comes over to Phil and Helen's and serves paper. She meant that she wants a divorce. So now we're in the court system, and there's dates on there that show up at the court at this time and be ready to talk about this. You know, it's starting to dissolve monies, property, those kinds of things, and dissolve the marriage. AA has a prayer, a third step prayer that begins with the words, God, I offer myself to thee. I learned that prayer, and it's a part of my recovery. And when I pray that prayer, I mean it. It's just become one of the anchors in my life to keep me tied into a loving God. I do my best to work a complete program and to come for recovery and not just relief. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. You know, I used to think that that said, made a fearless moral inventory of ourselves and others, but it doesn't, because I'm so much better at taking others' inventories. But I came this time, I was broken, and I came with that gift of desperation. I came crushed, and I came willing to make a fearless and moral inventory of myself. When I went back, I'm living with Phil and Helen. I'm working my project down in Denver. I'm barely sleeping. Barely eating. Friday comes, and I can't wait to get back to my old Friday night meeting that I hadn't been to for 10 years now. So I go back to that church, and there's that meeting again. A lot of the faces are different. I give them a thumbnail sketch of what's going on in my life, and then I just break down weeping and sobbing. And, you know, you do what you do. They held me. They hugged me. They told me, keep coming back. They invited me out to coffee and pie after the meeting. We talked. They listened. You made me feel so welcome, and I'm grateful for that. I took my inventory. When it came time, I took my inventory, and I used the method my sponsor showed me to use. It was a four-column method. The first column is who and what they did, and three is how it affected me, and four is what's my part? Where did I contribute? And that was a real effective inventory for me. I took it as thoroughly, as honestly, as fearlessly as I could, and I meant all of it. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. We say in our opening, our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. Well, sometimes I think I know it when I'm becoming irritable and unreasonable, and sometimes I just let it go on and on. I let it, that's the way I operate. Well, now I'm on a new path, and I need to find something different to do. I need to practice some of these new principles that we talk about. Step five, it was odd, because step five, it brought focus and perspective to my life all at once. It just pinpointed some things, but it's like I was seeing everything with new eyes. I was hearing things with new ears. My heart was open, and I was interested. I wanted to surrender myself to the principles of this program. It also rid me of any denial that I was innocent. You know, I came to realize where I had contributed to the demise of my marriage, to all my troubles, not just that, but to all the difficulties I had. It brought perspective into my life. That step, admitting to God, to myself, and to another human being, admission, it's an incredibly powerful tool, and it's one of my favorite spiritual principles. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. When I first saw that, when I first started going through this, I thought, God's going to make all my character defects disappear. Well, he didn't. You know, my resentment, my fears, my selfishness, my self-righteousness, all of that stuff, my criticism, my critical spirit, all those things, they're still there. They're still there. I was entirely ready to let go of those old tools. I was entirely ready to let go of my resentments, my fear, my critical spirit, all of those things. I was entirely ready to practice new tools like gratitude and humility, to practice serenity, courage, and wisdom, to practice meeting with a sponsor, to talk regularly with a loving God, and to set a time aside to meditate and listen for God to speak into my life. I was ready for a new path. So I'm living with Phil and Helen. I work my project down in Denver. I go to my Friday night meeting. Saturday comes and I'm at Phil and Helen's. And if I was in my home, I know what I'd be doing. I'd be doing my yard chores. I'd be doing raking, mowing, something, fixing the fence, something. So Phil and Helen call me down to breakfast. And I'm still overcome with grief and shock. And they see it in me. And I tell Phil, you know, if you have raking or mowing to do or whatever, I'm your guy. I can fix fence, whatever you need. So that morning, Phil and I just start doing house chores there, like we would do, like I would do at my house. About lunchtime, Helen comes. She says it's time for lunch. She's made some sandwiches. We go and wash up, and we sit down and have a lunch. And boy, they were just patient and loving with me, and they didn't make me talk about anything I didn't want to talk about. They listened if I had something to say. And then Helen says, you know, we knew each other from church, and we had been in a Bible study before. And Helen says, there's another church about 2 miles from here. And I hear it's a really good church, and they have 2 services on Sunday morning. And she says, they're starting the Saturday evening service tonight. And she said she was intending on going. And I think it was her intention to invite me to go with them. But before she could invite me, I invited myself because I knew I needed to connect again with a loving God and not that, not the God that I had before, that punitive God, the God that, anyways, I needed to connect with a loving God. So that evening comes and we go to a new church, and it's a big church. I don't know. There's, 800 seats in there. I don't know, maybe more. But it's a big auditorium. There's a dais up there like this platform with the musicians, and there's a greeting. The musician, we sang some hymns, and they're familiar. There's some announcements. And then the pastor gets up, and he introduces a guest speaker. And this grandfatherly looking man gets up, and he's a minister. He's a pastor in the Washington, D.C. area, and he ministers to congressmen, to senators, to those types of people, some people with some clout. And here he is at this church, and he gets up and he starts talking about fear. He starts talking about how cancer showed up in his life. He just received a recent diagnosis of cancer, and he talked about that fear. And it's 2005, and he talked about 9/11 and those fears. He talked about economic fears. It was at a time when people were starting to lose their jobs and money was becoming just really tight, and the economy was getting a little bit scary. He talked about World War II fears and as a little boy, what it was like for him to go through World War II, watching his dad, his relatives go off to the war, and fear of the unknown. And he talked about other fears. And about halfway through the sermon, he starts talking about a loving God. And he starts sharing all these passages about how big God is and how great his love is. And he talks about a God whose love can overcome anything, a God whose love can overcome everything. And all we need to do is surrender to that love. And at the end of his sermon, he says, if fear has showed up in your life, I want to pray for you. And he says, if you have health fears, raise your hand. I want to pray for you. Some hands go up. And he says, if you have financial fears, if money's tight, and you have those fears, I want to pray for you. Raise your hand. And then he says, if you have a relationship fear, if there's a relationship that's coming unraveled, I want to pray for you. And we're sitting 3/4 of the way to the back there, Helen and Phil and myself. And I start this uncontrollable sobbing and grieving. And I stand up because I want him to see me. And I raise my hand. And I hear him say, yeah, I see you all the way in the back. And he says a couple more things, and then he prays. And there's a hymn, and then we're dismissed. And I know I'm going to know somebody there. And I sit down, and I can't stop this grieving. And I sit down, and this hand comes over from behind me. And I'm shaking, and I'm grieving. And I hear him say, "Eloy, what's wrong?" And it was my old sponsor that I hadn't seen for the last 9 years, sitting right behind me there. And we reconnected, and we started working the program again. Step 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. I believe God recognizes authentic humility. I think God also recognizes my authentic rebellion. And I think he acts accordingly on both. I did my best. To humbly surrender to God's will and for whatever was to come. If Kathy and I were going to divorce, and I have to admit, although it was still very uncomfortable, I did find a measure of peace. I was starting to believe in a God whose love is enough, and no matter what. So as long as I have a loving God, I'll be okay. Doesn't mean it's going to be convenient and comfortable. It might be rocky and difficult, but it'll be okay. So now it's late August or early September. We separated June 20th and went through all that summer, and I'm living with Phil and Helen, and I'm working my projects. And I've been working Alan on as hard as I could. When I went to my Friday night meeting that first time back in June, I picked up a meeting list. I did not know there were about 15 meetings in the Fort Collins area. I thought there was just that one. So now I'm going to every meeting I can. I'm using the phone list. I'm doing my prayer, my meditation. I'm going to church, but with a brand new heart, a brand new mind, a brand new spirit in me. And I am open to listening to whatever God has to say to me. There's another court appearance. This is the second court appearance, and we're dissolving monies and property. And then as we're closing out that court appearance, the court orders me to show up at the house October 15th, Saturday, October 15th. Oh, I never made that connection before. Wow. That just occurred to me. Wow. And be ready to move out of the house. So I made arrangements for a big truck and about 5 of my friends. And I told the guys, Kathy, I know Kathy, she'll be organized. She'll have things ready to go, and it should take us 2 hours. I think we can do this in 2 hours, Toph. So we get to the house, and it's just like I said, Kathy's there. And, you know, when Kathy asked me to leave and whatever communication we had in between, and even prior to that in our marriage, there were never any slammed doors. There was never any raging. Our fights were, I don't know how to say it, probably boring, maybe boring for some of you. But, you know, oftentimes we left with hurt feelings, or we didn't feel heard by the other one. Or we didn't finish a conversation, our fight, whatever. There was no resolution. So we get to the house, and I tell the guys it'll take us maybe 2 hours, and they start loading up. I keep pointing at things, and they start loading up, and there's Kathy's there. And about an hour and a half into it, I can see we're going to hit about that 2 hour mark. So I go let Kathy know, and I noticed it occurred to me I hadn't seen her for a while. So I go looking for Kathy, and I find her in her sewing room, and she's got her face in her hands there. And she's weeping softly to herself, and I hear her say, "This just isn't right. This just isn't right." And I drop to my knees, and I tell her how very much I love her and how I'm willing to go to any length to reconcile our marriage. You know, when we met, I think she saw a guy who's ushering at a church, so has some church connection. I was going to Al-Anon, and she knew I was going to Al-Anon, so I think she saw a guy who was working on himself, but it was just really a shell and really just a facade. But I think that day she saw something authentic in me, that I had been working and that there was a new spirit in me. And, you know, she said again, this just isn't right. And I told her, I have a court order, and unless you say stop, I've got to keep going. Well, I let her know again how much I loved her and how I was willing to go to any length to reconcile. But she didn't say stop. So we finished loading up the truck and we left. I went back to, by now I had an apartment, and I had the guys just put the stuff in the garage. I told them I'd deal with it later. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make direct amends to, and became willing to make amends to them all. Here's what I hear in that step. Does somebody suffer because I suffer? And I think Kathy suffered because I was suffering. You know, I'm the one that brought the disease into my house. Kathy is not alcoholic. My adult children are not alcoholic. I brought in the resentment, the fears, all of that stuff, the critical spirit, the irritability, all of those things. I brought that into the house. And Kathy was at the top of my list to make amends. Whenever I found an opportunity, I would do that. Here's where I added a fifth column to my inventory. And that fifth column is, what are the spiritual principles that apply here? What's God's will for me here? Do I need to ask for forgiveness or extend forgiveness? Do I need to extend patient, encouraging, understanding, like we talk about in Tradition 5? What's God's will for me here? Step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, there's no shortcuts here. It says direct amends when possible, and then it gives you an exception. So before I made any of my amends, I reviewed everything with God and with my sponsor before I was going to act. A week or so after I moved out, I'm not sure who called who. Kathy called me or I called Kathy. And it was just a how are you doing call. It was quiet and there was a lot of space in there, but how are you doing? How's everything going? How are the kids? You okay? It was just one of those calls, just caring and a lot of quiet in that call. And about another week later, there was another one of those calls. How's everything going? Are you okay? And a few days later, there was another one. And Kathy said, why don't you come over Saturday? And I said, okay, I'd really like to do that. I told her I've got an Al-Anon meeting Saturday morning, but I'll be over after that. We wrap up around 10:30 or so, and I'll be over about 11. So it's November now, and I moved out of the house, and I go to my meeting, I go to the house. And it's snowing. There's about 3 inches of snow down, and it's still, those big fluffy white flakes are just coming straight down. And pretty day, really. And I ring the doorbell at a door that I used to just walk through at one time in my old house, and sit down. And I'm sitting over here, and Kathy's sitting over there. And how are you doing? And there's a lot of space again in the conversation, a little bit of awkwardness. And you don't want to rush anything. You don't want to say anything inappropriate. None of those you never or you always statements. Just caring. And after a while, I suggest, let's go up to Rocky Mountain Park, Rocky Mountain National Park. It's up a canyon. It's about 50 miles from where we lived. And we had hiked the Dickens out of that just a few years earlier. There's plenty of trails there to hike. And if you haven't been to Colorado, Rocky Mountain National Park, don't leave without visiting Rocky Mountain National Park. But we drove up to Estes, which is the little town right at the foothill of the park. And then we drove into the park over to Sprague Lake, and snow's still coming down. We're in a big parking lot. We've got the whole place to ourselves. Nobody else is there. And we walk around to the backside of the lake. And the parking lot's over there, and it's sunk down a little bit. The lake's right in front of us. It's covered with snow. It's frozen over. There's these huge spruce trees with the boughs catching all the snow. And there's the Rocky Mountains there. And it sounds corny, but it was kind of like a Hallmark moment. But that's where I made my amends to Kathy. And that's where she made her amends to me. And that's where we hugged for a good long time. And we drove back to Estes. We had a lunch there, a really nice lunch there. And now it really feels like a first date again, like we're dating again. We drove back down the canyon. I drove her to her home. I said, we'll call tomorrow. We'll talk again tomorrow. She said, that'd be great. So now we're calling each other every day now. She invited me over for Thanksgiving that year. And we had a real nice Thanksgiving with the kids and Kathy and myself. And it's end of November now. And I tell Kathy, I've got a project coming up in Steamboat Springs, which is about 3.5 hours over the mountains there. And I'd be living at a motel for the next two and a half weeks or so to get that project done. But we'll call each other every day. And it was a snowy winter that year, a cold, snowy winter that year. So December comes and I go to that project in Steamboat Springs and we're calling each other every day. And the day comes, it's a wrap. We're doing one last final walkthrough early morning, make sure we've got everything completed. And I call Kathy about 9 o'clock and I say, it's, you know, we're coming home, we're done. And she says, why don't you stop by the house before you go to your apartment? And I'll have some soup here for you. I thought, that sounds great. And I really, really, I cared more about seeing Kathy than I did about the soup. So I drove back home. And when I got back home, Kathy surprised me by having all my stuff moved back in. So we're still together. This weekend, she's at some of our... she's at some of our grandson's games. We have... our son has two boys, 14 and 11. They're into football. Our daughter has two boys. They're into soccer and ice hockey. So she's at an ice hockey game today, and she was at a football game yesterday. So that's our life, going to a lot of games these days. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So I review daily with God. My sponsor told me how he has a little chime on his phone that goes off about bedtime for him, and he reviews his day. So I've done that also, put a little chime on my phone about 10 o'clock at night. So when it goes off, I know to review my day and talk to God about it and see if I owe anybody anything. Do I owe an amends any place? How did I conduct myself today? The other thing I review, how I worked my program. Did I work my program today? Because erosion sets in if I don't work my program. And I made it a point to work a thorough program. I go to meetings. I have a sponsor. I have the God of my understanding. I work the steps with both of them. I do service work and challenging service work. And I do my step 11 work. I pray and I meditate. That's my program. That's the program that I work. I don't take any shortcuts. I try to be as accountable as best I can. And service, I remember kind of being afraid of service and what it was going to commit me to. But I've come to embrace service. Service is where my program moved forward. I've served as area chair, and that is the position that I love the most because it was the most challenging position for me. And that is the program, that's the service that really kept me on my knees, taking my stand on my knees before a loving God. Because we have challenges at our assemblies also. And when those challenges show up, I've come to embrace them. You know, yesterday at 3:30, there was a pretty, let's call it passionate discussion here. And we have those discussions, but that's where the program shows up. You know, it's easy to practice these principles when everything's smooth sailing and the water's just nice and easy. But the real practice comes when it's rough, when life is unfair, inconvenient, and unsecured. That's when we get to really work the program. And that's at the grocery store, at the bank, driving through traffic, coming back to my family. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where we get to practice these principles in all our affairs. Where am I at here? I did 10. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as we understood him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, I'm taking these deep breaths up here, and I said it yesterday at the DR meeting. You know, we're pretty close to sea level here, and where I come from, it's dry air, and we're at about 5,000 feet. My lungs feel like they're swimming. I just feel so thick here. Step 11, I've heard it said that God doesn't make difficult deals with those who seek him. I ask God to relieve me from my self-righteousness, my critical spirit, my low self-esteem, from all those things. And I ask God for knowledge of his will for my life, just for today. And I do my best to surrender to that. And today I can look back at my past, and I can see places where God showed up anonymously in my life. You know, some of the jobs that I've had, some of the people that I've met, just different things that I've had. I look now and I can see where God just quietly guided me through life more than I ever thought before. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. A spiritual awakening means taking God into account into all facets of my life. Al-Anon taught me how to invite God into all the conversations going on in my life, whether it's with my marriage, with stepchildren, with grandchildren. And I've appreciated that. I've learned not to withhold anything from God. God already knows. It's just a matter of fact for me to admit it to him and to come to realize my part in whatever it is. You know, and I don't believe in a spiritual awakening because I read it in one of our books. I believe in a spiritual awakening because it happened to me. I told you about getting to that point in life where I started seeing things new and hearing things fresh, and my heart was open to all the spiritual principles of this program. The other thing is that it says practice these principles in all our affairs. It's easy to practice the spiritual principles in these rooms here, even when it's a difficult conversation. But the real practice begins when we leave these rooms and go back to our communities, to our families, to our life. I begin this share by telling you about my brother, Ted. And he passed away a year and a half ago. Ted got sober October 15th, 1986. 6 months, he was out in California. I'm living in Colorado. My mom and my oldest brother and his wife were living in New Mexico. And 6 months after Ted got sober, he was in a horrific accident. No alcohol was involved. Alcohol was not involved in that accident. And Ted had his right arm severed, clean up to his shoulder here, just like that in that accident. So he's out in California. I get the call in Colorado. My mom and my brother and his wife get it in New Mexico that Ted's in critical condition. He's right on the edge, not sure which way it's going to go, if he's going to make it or not. So we all make arrangements to fly out to California. And we get to the hospital there, and it's in the Van Nuys, Pacoima area. And we're in the intensive care with, there's Ted laid out on a gurney. And somehow they've managed to reattach that arm to Ted, seeing if it'll take. And I wish I could tell you more of Ted's story. It's an incredible story. But the doctor comes in, and we've been praying and crying and grieving over Ted. It's iffy whether he's going to make it or not. He lost a lot of blood, and the doctor comes in, and he says it's lose his arm or lose his life. We're going to have to take the arm. It's just not working. So, you know, we accepted that, and the next morning, the doctor lets us know it was a successful operation. They're going to keep him in an induced coma for the next 3 or 4 days to help stabilize him and manage the pain. AA was in the room also, not in the intense, not in the ICU unit. They only had a lot of family in that unit, but AA is in the waiting room. So they're talking to us, and they stayed with us. Whenever we were at the hospital, AA would show up. And so now they've moved, the third or fourth day, they moved Ted into a regular room. He's stable, and he's going to be okay. He's going to come through. And they tell us we're going to bring him out of his coma today. And AA's in the room with us, and Ted's coming too, and we've been talking to him all the time he's been out, and letting him know where he's at and what happened and everything that's going on. And I'll never forget, Ted's coming too, and the very first thing he asks, did I maintain my sobriety? Because he's been given all these drugs, and AA was right there to reassure him that, yes, those drugs were given to you to save your life, not to take it from you. So, yes, you maintained your sobriety. We stayed with Ted a few more days. And then we all left back to Colorado and New Mexico. And about 8 months later, I fly back out to California to go see Ted, because Ted and I are close. We grew up in Boy Scouts together, playing football together. Ted and I were really close, even through his drinking years. I was the one pouring his drinks down the drain. I was that guy. But I went out about 8 months later to go see Ted, and he's got his little apartment, and there he is with, you know, I knew what I expected, you know, his a sleeveless shirt, and, you know, there's nothing there, and he needs to do laundry one night. So we go down to this laundry room at his apartment complex, and I'm helping Ted with his laundry, and I see Ted put a hanger in his mouth and with his left hand, hang the shirt on there and work to button a button. And I see him put one sock down and then another sock on top of it. And you know how you roll it up and make it into that little sock ball? Well, he's grabbing it with his teeth to make it into that little sock ball. And I'm helping Ted with his stuff. But I just remember that picture of Ted, because in my mind today, in my mind, I think my spirit only has one arm. And in my mind, I see two toolboxes. Over here's all my old tools, my resentments, my fears, my self-righteousness, my critical spirit, all of those things, my selfishness, all of those things, my dishonesty. And over here's another toolbox, serenity, courage, and wisdom, sponsor, a loving God, meetings, literature, slogans, all those things. And in my mind's eye, I think my spirit, like Ted, only has one arm. And when I pick up fear over here, I let go of courage over here. And when I pick up forgiveness over here, I let go of resentments over here. I can only hold one thing at one time, at one moment. And I get to choose moment by moment which toolbox I'm going to pick up. I hope you heard a loving story, a story about love today, a loving story. And not so much about the love between a man and a woman, but about a loving God, a God whose love is enough that no matter how unfair, how difficult life is, if you have God's love, it'll be okay. And I've come to accept that, that no matter how hard life gets, I am convinced God loves me and I'll be okay. There's a verse that says, God so loved the world that he gave. That's the God I believe in. That's the God I love. That's the God that loves me. Miracles happen in this program. And it may not be the miracle you want, but it might be the very miracle that you need. And that's the miracle I had. I'm not perfect. I still need a program. I'm going to close, and I'm going to ask you all to stand, and I'm going to ask Dwayne to stand over here by the steps.
If you would get first.
No, I meet you over there.
Okay.
So here's how I'd like to close. Would you all stand? And take the hand of somebody next to you. And I'm going to close with, I'm going to change it up a bit. I'm going to close with a serenity prayer, followed by a moment of silence. So join me in the serenity prayer. God. And a moment of silence. Thank you.